Well, this is a little bit different from what you planned on this last of the series on the Beatitudes. For some reason or other, they didn't get that morning hour recorded. So I'm going to re-record it right now, just visit with you and tell you what I told them. And I believe it's important enough for me to do this in order for the series to be complete, but also because of what I think is the importance of this beatitude. But let me tell you what I told them this morning. Something so exciting happened last Sunday. The sermon was on Blessed Are the Peacemakers. And during that time, I told them one of the secrets of making peace is to take the first step. That is, to go to the one that offended you and get it ironed out. Well, after the hour was over, a man came up to me, a big, tall man, and he commended the sermon. But then he said, I have to tell you something. You offended me. And I said, oh, how did I offend you? He said, by your use of the expression, Jewing people down. He said, that's offensive to me. He said, I used to use that same expression until, almost by accident, he said, I became aware that I was part Jewish. Well, he said, ever since then, it has been offensive to him, and it should be. It's never appropriate, and I was aware that I had been justly criticized for having used that expression. So I apologized to him, and he accepted that. But we talked about what's an appropriate substitute. Anyway, I don't know that he recognized that he was actually putting into practice what Jesus had said to do to resolve difficulties. It wasn't until after he left, and he told me this morning after this second service, he said, I really wasn't aware of it until after I left that I had done the very thing Jesus said to do. But I became aware of it too. He had become the enfleshing of that seventh beatitude, Blessed Are the Peacemakers. He had gone to the person that offended him. I was that person. He confronted me. I repented and apologized. And then later on I realized, by the way, that's exactly what Jesus was asking us to do. So it's exciting to see the Beatitudes living and active among God's people. But let's just go briefly at a review. One of the perspectives of the Beatitudes, do you remember, was Jesus serving as the prism through which the unapproachable light of his Father came through and was diffused, broken down into its component parts, and Jesus himself being that embodiment of all that he taught. It comes out primarily in the Beatitudes, and then secondarily in all of the rest of the Sermon on the Mount and the other teachings of Jesus, and then in the rest of the entire New Testament. All of them focus back to Jesus Christ as the prism through which the unapproachable light of God is focused. So that was one perspective. Another perspective was the Beatitudes in terms of the believer's response. The believer's response in poverty of spirit and mourning is an evidence of repentance. And then I'm suggesting that the spirit of meekness is best demonstrated in our action of baptism as we surrender ourselves to the will of God. And then the last five Beatitudes, the hungry for and thirsting for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, and the persecuted, these are the life styles, or this is the lifestyle of the life of the believer. This is the way he lives. And then a third perspective is a kind of a journey up the spiritual mountain. Tim, in his book on the Beatitudes, Tim Woodruff, our son, in his book on the Beatitudes called Walk This Way, has the first four Beatitudes, poverty of spirit, mourning, meekness, and hungering for righteousness, that comes all the way up to the peak of the mountain. And then the last four, that of being merciful, pure in heart, peacemaker, and joyful in persecution, are the four Beatitudes that lead back down into the world to serve as lights in the darkness. I think the simplest one of these perspectives for me is that of a lighthouse, where each beatitude is built upon what goes before until it finally reaches the point where Jesus says, afterwards he said, you're the light of the world. A city sitting on a hill can't be hid. So we find that that is a real simple illustration demonstrating the dynamic of the Beatitudes. Then we also, you remember, we translated them into relationship language. Blessed are the poor in spirit translates, I was wrong. Blessed are those who mourn translates, I'm sorry. Blessed are the meek translates into relationship language, let's do what's best for you. And then blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness translates, let's do what's right regardless. And then blessed are the merciful translates, I forgive you. Blessed are the pure in heart translates, I love you only and I trust you completely. Then blessed are the peacemakers translates, let me be the first to make up. And then blessed are the persecuted that we'll notice today translates, I'll make allowance for your bad days. Because really that's what has to be done if relationships are to be maintained, if they're going to be repaired. All of these statements that are translations of the Beatitudes into relationship language, we must become adept at saying these things from the heart and meaning them. And in that way, we are able to build and maintain relationships. Well, this particular eighth Beatitude is like the others. It demonstrates this one simple truth. Jesus is the perfect equivalent of his own teaching. Now, I don't know how aware you are of the uniqueness of that situation, but it is a totally unique situation. Jesus is the only person who ever lived, the only philosopher who ever lived, whose life was the perfect equivalent of his own teaching. Now, there are a lot of philosophers and there are a lot of teachers, but their lives did not totally match their teaching, but Jesus did and does. So with all these others, in this eighth one, Jesus is the perfect example of someone who suffered unjustly for righteousness, but suffered in a godly way. We're going to look at that this morning. I ask the people to open their Bibles and turn to 1 Peter 4, 1 and 2. And they were going to look at the Beatitude, the eighth one, through the eyes of Simon Peter. We could look at it abstractly, but I decided the best way would be to go about 30 years on further into the first century since Jesus was among us, go about into about A.D. 65 or A.D. 60, and listen to what Simon Peter said as he reflected on the life of Jesus and on how Jesus handled suffering, how he handled persecution. And it's all through there. For years I missed this message. For one reason, I had a skewed concept of suffering. I had only the idea of the rack and the scourge and things of that nature where the Christians were actually persecuted and were killed. I did not see the suffering that comes from unequal relationships among parents and children and husbands and wives. I didn't see the suffering that comes from that. And it's one of the main sufferings that people undergo today, in America at least. And then I also had a limited concept of passions. I had in mind hatred and murder and lust and adultery, those heavy, black, dark passions. But what about just envy and jealousy, or maybe greed or feelings of self-pity? All of these, though they may not be as deadly on the surface, and yet you think about it, these are those human passions that suck the vitality out of life and rob life of its joy. And so I had missed this message because of a skewed concept of suffering and a limited concept of passions. But turning to 1 Peter 4, 1 and 2, there are four phrases, and I'd like for us to notice them in reverse order because I think that'll highlight and really give the message its the clarity that it needs. The first of these, which is the last one of the four, it simply says, as a result, he lives the rest of his life no longer by human passions, but by the will of God. And I just ask them, how many of you find that about 90% of your struggle as a Christian has to do with trying to get free from the human passions so that you can live by the will of God? That's where about 90% of my struggles come, of trying to get free from the gravitational pull of the flesh in order to live in the freedom of the sons of God under the will of God. And we all have that struggle. But he says here, as a result, he lives the rest of his earthly life no longer by human passions, but by the will of God. The words "as a result" imply that something that was just said above that is the key to living your life free from the human passions and free to live in the will of God. So as a result, he lives the rest of his earthly life. What is the key? Well, let's look at the phrase above it. For whoever has suffered in the body has ceased from sin. Does he mean whoever, just any whoever who has suffered in the body or who suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin? Well, I asked that question and I asked, do you believe that? And one lady in the audience said, no. I don't know where she was coming from, but it was interesting that she answered vocally, no, I don't believe that. Well, in a sense, I don't either. Not if you don't qualify it. And I ask, have you ever hit your thumb with a hammer? Well, yeah, I'm sure most of you have. Well, by the way, you didn't cease from sin when you did it. If anything came out of it, it caused you to sin. And I said, if you hadn't plugged that sin hole, sticking your thumb in your mouth, you probably would have sinned more. So it doesn't mean just anybody that suffers in the body has ceased from sin. There's something more. Well, look at the third phrase. Arm yourselves also with the same attitude. Oh, and we began to see then there's something connected with this that has to do with attitude. And that's the real key. But what attitude is it? Well, the first one of these phrases that we'll notice last is simply this. Therefore, since Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same attitude. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin. As a result, he lives the rest of his earthly life no longer by human passions, but by the will of God. Now, I want to give you an expanded translation of that. Listen to this and see if it's not what he's really saying. And it doesn't do violation to the text at all. Listen to it. Therefore, since Christ suffered in the flesh with a certain attitude towards suffering, arm yourselves also with that same attitude. For whoever has suffered in the body with that attitude of Christ towards suffering has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of his life, his earthly life, no longer by human passions, but by the will of God. Now, I think that's what he's saying. I don't believe that twists the scripture or pushes it beyond its original meaning. Let me read it again. Therefore, since Christ suffered in the flesh with a certain attitude towards suffering, arm yourselves with that same attitude. For whoever has suffered in the flesh with the attitude Christ had towards suffering has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of his life no longer by human passions, but by the will of God. So, there's your key, and yet there's still something missing. Look, if you will, Matthew 5:10 is the beatitude, blessed are those that are persecuted for righteousness. And this statement in 1 Peter 4:1 and 2, they address the same subject, and here it is. How to suffer unjustly without losing your joy. If we can grasp this principle, we will have discovered one of the real jewels of the kingdom. Now, this is the general message of 1 Peter. It's all the way through 1 Peter. It's in virtually every chapter, if not in every chapter, more than one time. There are probably 6 or 8, maybe 10 times that he mentions sufferings throughout his first letter that he wrote. Then specifically, Peter parallels chapter 4, 1 and 2 with chapter 2, 20 through 23. And I've already read the one in 4, 1 and 2, and check on it in your Bibles, but listen to this. When it says, but if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps. He committed no sin and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he didn't retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. So Peter looks at this specifically and parallels these two passages. And yet, let's go further. look at the context of chapter 2, 21 through 23, or 20 through 23. In chapter 2, verses 18 through 20, just before he calls on our looking at Christ as our example of suffering, he addresses suffering unjustly in the workplace. Listen to this. Slaves, submit yourselves to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. For it is commendable if a man bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because he's conscious of God. Well, that's the workplace. Slavery was the forum or the area in which people worked there commercially. That was their commercial setting. So you could say that he's talking about here unjust suffering in the workplace. But then on over in chapter 3, right after he talked about the suffering of Christ, he said, wives, in the same way, be submissive to your husbands, so that if any of them do not believe the word, they may be won over without words by the behavior of their wives, when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. Well, there he's talking about enduring suffering on the home front, in the home, the relationships there between the husband and wife. And this implies, and in fact, it demands that we recognize that he's writing this to women whose husbands were not believers. They were either Jewish or pagan disbelievers. And he says the same thing there, that they're to be in subjection and submission. But notice, these are both unequal relationships. In the workplace, he said, don't be subject just to those bosses or those masters who were not only to those who are good and considerate masters, but also to those who are harsh. So he calls on them to be aware and to be submissive and obedient even to harsh masters. Well, that's hard to handle, isn't it? And then to the women over here, it was an unequal relationship there. They were called on. So you find these unequal relationships, and that Simon Peter is calling us by the authority of Christ, I think. In fact, he points to Christ as an example of that. But you might want to ask, well, what did Jesus know about unequal relationships? That's the only kind of relationship he knew anything about on earth. He didn't have any equal relationship. The nearest thing Jesus came to an equal relationship was in the home of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And there it really wasn't equal. There Jesus could take off his sandals, could relax, and just kind of let the cares of the world go by, and Mary sitting there listening attentively to his teachings. But all of a sudden, Martha would burst through the kitchen door and start accusing him. Don't you realize that Mary has left me to do all the serving? And then she said, tell her to come in here and help me. Well, that ruined the occasion, or threatened to. And Jesus said, oh, Martha, Martha, you're troubled about a lot of things. One thing is needful, and Mary has chosen the better part, and it'll not be taken away from her. But he just didn't have any equal relationships. And may I suggest that neither do you and I. We don't have any real equal relationships. I heard a man, when I said this on one occasion, he said, well, my wife and I have an equal relationship. I said, hold on just a moment. Let me call your wife and see what she says about it. I bet you she'd say, well, it's not quite as equal as he thinks it is. But in both of these examples, on the work front and in the home front, we're told to follow Jesus' example. Well, in 1 Peter 2, 20, in that area where it says what he did, but he doesn't say how he did it. He committed no sin. No deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he didn't retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. He tells what he did, but he doesn't tell how he did it. How did he do that? Well, in order to understand how he did it, we'll have to go to his Sermon on the Mount, go back to the platform on which he did his teaching and the basis on which he did his living. If you'll go to Luke's record of that in the 6th chapter of Luke, we learn his philosophy, how Jesus suffered unjustly without losing his joy. Here's a statement I want to state right at the very front, because I believe with all my heart that this is the secret. This is the key. And here it is. You learn how to live only when you learn how to give. Let me say that again. You learn how to live only when you learn how to give. There are two styles of giving mentioned in this Luke 6. I'm going to turn there to it, and just turn with me while you're at it, and let's notice these two kinds of giving. One is the giving of the world, the way the world gives. It's found beginning in verse 32 of chapter 6 of Luke. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners love those who love them. And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners, expecting to be repaid in full. Well, that's the way the world gives. We call it, it's generally known, there is a kind of giving that's giving with strings attached. Giving that expects something in return. And nobody likes to receive a gift like that. There are a lot of political giving, and there's a lot of giving that has ulterior motives. Giving expecting something in return. Well, that's just the way the world gives. Our children give like that. Parents give like that in front of them. Husbands, they give to their wives with ulterior motives. You know, giving expecting something in return. And I had them call to mind, the men this morning. I said, have you ever given something to your wife expecting something in return? And there was this sullen silence. They knew that they had done that when they had plans for the evening, you know, and they come home with a box of candy and going to butter up their wife and get her in a good mood. And they present the box of candy to her, and instead of her doing like they thought she would do, jump up and down or be so happy and grab him around the neck and kiss him, it's possible that she says, you know I can't eat that, I'm on a diet. And then she said, furthermore, that's not the kind of chocolate I like, it's the kind you like. So she shoots him out of the saddle before he can even get off the horse. And as a result, the men usually go into their favorite mode whenever people don't appreciate, whenever their wife doesn't appreciate his gift. Husbands have a tendency to go into the pout mode, the P-O-U-T mode. And we're good at it. Women don't pout, they just get real quiet. But men, we pout. Well, it's because of the fact that we were depending on her giving a certain response to our gift. But our gift had strings attached. It's still the world's style of giving, and if the gift does not bring about the proper response, it destroys our joy or ruins our happiness. But that's the way the world gives. Then there's Jesus' style of giving, and it's also mentioned in Luke 6, just ahead of the one I just read about the way the world gives. Jesus said, but I tell you who hear me, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. If someone strikes you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone takes your cloak, do not stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, do not demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. And then over in verse 35 he says, but love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them, without expecting to get anything back. Wow, that's quite an order. But that's the way he gives. That's the way he gave then. It's the way he gives today. He gives with just because giving is good, and he does not give with strings attached. He wants us, but he doesn't have any selfish motive, and his joy isn't dampened by our lack of response, except as he would love to have us with him. But he simply says, love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to get anything back. Then your reward will be great, and you'll be sons of the Most High, because he's kind to the ungrateful and wicked. So we find him calling us to a different kind of giving. And he goes on and says, don't judge and you'll not be judged. Do not condemn and you'll not be condemned. And listen to this, forgive and you will be forgiven. And again, give and it will be given to you. A good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over will be poured into your lap. For with the measure you use, it will be measured to you. Now he refers to the natural consequence of giving without strings attached. He says, if you'll give like that, It's going to be given back to you in abundance. Well, essentially, in this section where Jesus' philosophy is mentioned, Jesus says simply, risk the danger of being hurt. If someone slaps you on one cheek, turn the other cheek. Don't build up walls of protection against the emotional hurt that comes by unrequited love. And then second, he said, do to others as you would have them do to you. Use that as your measuring stick. And then give, expecting nothing in return. It's a kind of giving that allows you to be free from the response that the receiver gives to your gift, so that your emotional well-being, your joy, doesn't depend upon the response that the receiver gives. And so as a result, you're liberated from the roller coaster ride emotionally that goes up and down, simply because of the varying response that people give to what you do for them. He just says, give expecting nothing in return. It produces a detachment. It produces a type of detachment. And that can become bad if you just become totally detached from somebody. But it does allow you to rise up above your circumstances and the things that happen to you, to where your joy doesn't depend upon the other person's response to your giving. And that's important. Otherwise, you're going to be victimized and become the victim of their response to your gift. And no one wants that kind of an up and down roller coaster ride. There was a woman in College Station, Texas. She was not a Christian. Her marriage was in shambles. I think she had attempted suicide two or three times. She would become so distraught, she would just get in her car and drive away and leave the children at the house. The neighbors knew her well enough to know when this was happening, and they would go get the children and take care of them, bathe them and feed them. And then she would finally come back home. But some Christian women in that church advised her to come in and talk to me. They had asked her several times, and she had refused. But then finally, she became desperate enough that she came and talked. She came in and sat down and began to unload all of this garbage about her husband. He must have been a real clod. And I don't say that judgmentally, but from what she said, he must have been one. Well, anyway, I said to her, I said, I bet you give in a lot to him, don't you? Well, I shouldn't have asked, because she started out, opened up another bag of garbage. She said, that's all I do is give in to him. I give in to him constantly. And I stopped her and I said, listen to me. Don't ever give in to your husband again, ever. Well, she looked at me strangely and said, what are you talking about? I said, just what I said. Don't give in to him again, ever. I said, ma'am, you're going to have to learn to give to him rather than give in to him. Instead of giving in to him, you're going to have to learn to give to him. And there's such a difference in those two. To give in to someone says essentially to them, you're worrying me to death. I'm so sick of your begging and pleading and carrying on. And you finally give in to them. It happens with parents and their children. It happens between a husband and wife, and a wife and a husband. Giving in simply says essentially, you're worrying me to death. You are a zero to me. And I'm going to do this, or I'm going to give it to you to get you off my back. Well, that's not a very good way to build a relationship. The other way, when you give to somebody, when you choose to give to them, it says not that you're a zero, you're my hero, and I want to treat you in a way that's loving and kind. Now, that may take time. It may not come on your time schedule. Well, when I told the woman that, I said, you're going to have to give to him. Stop giving in to him. Well, it was like a light turned on in her brain. I never have seen anyone just almost sit bolt right up. And she said, well, I can't believe I've never done that to my husband. She said, I've given to friends. I've given to them, but I've never given to my husband. I've always just given in to him. And I don't know what happened. I don't know the rest of the story, but there's a big principle there. That's if you're listening, that there's a valuable principle there if you can learn to give rather than give in. Now, two things I need to say. You may never change your mate. You may never change your boss at work. You may never, ever change them. They may go to their graves the same way they are right now, harsh and unpredictable and abusive. You may never change them. But Jesus didn't place the blessing on the person that's doing the abusing. He placed the blessing upon the abused. Let me say that again. He didn't place the blessing on the abuser. He placed the blessing on the abused. He said, "Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And so your mate or your boss at work may never change, but you can change your response by giving rather than giving in, and by doing to others as you'd have them do to you, and to risk the danger of being hurt, and to give expecting nothing in return. And then second, there are those of you who are living in abusive situations. I don't believe that Jesus wants you to live in a situation where your life is endangered. But this thought, one of the toughest things perhaps that you can give your mate, is that of tough love. You may have to tell that person, "You can't live here," or "I will not live here any longer with you living like that." If that person is asking, if that person is speaking disparagingly about your Lord, if that person is acting in a way that's destructive of your relationship and that is actually endangering your life or the well-being of your children, you may very well have to extend to him the toughest gift yet, and that is tough love. You may have to say, "You can't live here any longer until you change. I will not let you destroy yourself and your family." And if it means that you have to leave, fair enough. If you'll be sure that your motive is right and that you're doing this to preserve your marriage rather than destroy it, then I think you're all right by administering tough love. There's a verse I want to read to you from Hebrews that I did not read this morning. So this is a better, this will be even more than what you would have gotten on the original tape. In Hebrews, I think it's the 12th chapter beginning in verse 2. Listen to this. After stating that the great honor roll of faith in chapter 11, he says in chapter 12, verse 1, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us." Now listen to this. "Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart." And so with that admonition from the Hebrew writer, may I urge you to do the same thing. Fix your eyes on Jesus and remember what he suffered, and do this so that you won't lose heart and grow weary. By doing this, you'll be able to live your life as one of the blessed persecuted ones, because you will have learned the philosophy that Jesus used to do that same thing so that he didn't lose his joy when he suffered.